no matter what you're doing, no matter how far out it is, or how sophisticated, how complicated it is, because a lot of modern jazz is like super complicated, you know. There needs to be this aspect to the music that you're making that connects to a universal human experience, you know, something that you can relate to, even if you don't know what the hell is going on, you know, because if your music loses that, then it becomes a little, you know, academic or like not as meaningful. So even when you're making these turns that are surprising, there needs to be this sense of telling a human story, you know, and that's, you know, something that I try to keep in my concept.
Welcome to episode 113 of the Bass Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. What's up, folks? On the podcast is Marty Eisenberg. Marty Eisenberg is he's kind of a staple on the New York scene. He works as a jazz bass player. He works on Broadway. He works in classical groups, I guess is the way to say that. But he's here on the podcast talking about his latest record called The Way I Feel Inside. Now, I got hip to Marty because his PR team reached out to me and told me about the record. And before I had checked it out, before I listened to the record, just understanding and reading about the record in the PR release, the EPK, I was automatically fascinated because this music is inspired by Wes Anderson films, right? So I'm already intrigued because this is a fresh approach to composition and creating a collection of music to release as a record. So then I checked out the record. I really dug the record, and it took some turns that I did not anticipate, which made me love it even more. Again, the name of that record is called "The Way I Feel Inside." Here are some words from Marty about the album. There's something beautiful about creating a collage of sounds that aren't supposed to fit together, and yet they form a complex picture of a life with contradictions. It's that unconventional juxtaposition that drew me to this project and inspired me to explore this music through a new genre, jazz. A mixtape is a personal, intimate reflection of what we want to show others about ourselves, and this album is my own spin on that concept. A journey into my inner life through this collage of meaningful music in my own voice as a composer and a jazz musician. It's an album inspired by the songs and media that expressed how I feel in my younger years. Excuse me, how I felt in my younger years. But it is not a replication of that media. It's a series of diary entries, a statement about identity and culture, and an exploration of genre and style. Yeah, bring it, Marty, bring it. It's beautiful. I love that. So we do, me and Marty definitely talk about his new album, and we, you know, talk about his backstory a little as well, and explore some ideas about all of it. On Saturday, August 26th, the 6th annual Kahuna Concert for a Cause will be held in San Clemente, California. Kahuna Cares Foundation hosts a variety of events and campaigns to raise funds for the special needs community. Kahuna Cares supports Surfers Healing, which is the original surf camp for children with autism. Kahuna Cares also supports the Bass Shed Academy. Beginning later this year, I'll be presenting music appreciation classes with an emphasis on the bass for those with special needs. We'll be listening through music and, you know, kind of picking out the bass and bass lines. I'll have some basses with me that the class can learn about and hold and maybe generate some sounds on. I'm excited to engage with the special needs community through music, and I'm very thankful for the support of Kahuna Cares Foundation. For more information about the 6th annual Kahuna Cares Concert for a Cause, stop by kahunacares.org. You can also stop by the bassshedacademy.org. If you would like to donate to the programs for those with special needs, you can email me directly at ryan@thebassshed.com or email me through the Bass Shed Academy website. All right, also in San Clemente, is lemurmusic.com. Everything you need for the double bass, stop by lemurmusic.com. Check out their inventory on basses, bows, rosins, accessories. Man, this is like my fourth take doing this lemur ad. I keep saying accessory. Like, that's not even a word. Accessory. It feels really funny to say. Like, just the shape. Accessory. Accessories. Accessories. I gotta practice saying that. Just accessories. Bows, basses, rosin, accessories. Bows, basses, rosin, accessories. Yeah, I'm leaving it in. No edits on that one. LemurMusic.com. Use the promo code TheBassShed for 10% off. All right, as I mentioned, Marty Eisenberg is my guest on this episode. And it was a wonderful time. Wonderful time talking with Marty. And again, his album is titled The Way I Feel Inside. Check it out. I will have links up to it at TheBassShed.com. Backslash podcast, you can find it there, and also probably like whatever platform you are listening to this on, there's probably going to be links below in the description there. So check out Marty Eisenberg's new album, and here's my talk with New York double bassist Marty Eisenberg.
Hey Ryan.
Hey man, how you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Is it Martin or Marty? Which one is...
I go by Marty.
You go by... Yeah. Okay. You prefer that?
Yeah, I should change that. I do, yeah.
Okay.
Martin's too formal.
I always wonder, like, with people that have nickname options, at what point do you decide to make the switch?
For me, it was like kindergarten, you know? Like, I wanted everybody to know that I was cool, you know?
I wasn't... You gotta be Marty. You gotta be Marty.
Yeah.
That's funny. Like, my mom's, her name's Elizabeth, and she hated Liz. Yeah. And yeah. So me, my brother, and my sister all have names that, like, are not nicknameable.
Yeah, that's funny. I met a Martin the other day, and there's not a whole lot of people with this name, you know, right, nowadays. And, he told me, I asked him, like, do you prefer, like, did you ever think about calling yourself Marty? And he said, no, because I didn't want people to, like, think of the, like, movie Back to the Future.
It's and not I a was bad like, movie. There's worse
whenever
movies.
Whenever I, you know, like, have to order a coffee or something like that, I always say Marty, like Marty McFly, you know?
Yeah, okay.
But that's for some reference. Reason, he had the opposite reaction to it.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Man, thanks for doing this. Thanks for being on.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. We're definitely going to talk about your record, but let's talk a little bit about your backstory first.
Sure.
Is bass your first instrument?
So I guess I played a little piano when I was in elementary school. I took lessons, and then when I started band, you know, my first instrument was trombone.
Okay.
And we had one of those instrument fairs where the band director played all the instruments for us, and I picked trombone because it looked the most like a banana, you know.
as you do, you want
as
you
one
want
does.
The instrument to resemble produce, yeah.
when I was about 10, my father got diagnosed with cancer, and he ended up dying from it.
Oh wow!
And he played a lot of instruments around the house. He used to play mandolin for us and bass guitar and all these things. And so during the time when I was sort of, you know, processing all that, I took the bass guitar off the wall and I started, you know, learning songs. And it was like, you know, first of all, I just loved the sound of the bass, being a part of a band, you know, being in the role of sort of supporting other people, but it's always been a connection to my dad, you know. Being
okay.
Able to do that, yeah.
That's cool. Was he primarily a bass player?
No, he was a professor of Russian literature, but you know, he played in bands and stuff when he
okay.
was young, and
okay.
It was his hobby, one of his hobbies.
Okay, so you're Russian then, at least part.
Several okay. generations removed, yeah.
Okay, what else? What else ethnicity-wise?
Russian on my dad's side, Lithuanian on my mom's side, but you know, we've been, you know, and Jewish, but yeah. We've been, you know, for several generations American.
Okay. Cool. Have you ever been to either place, Russia or Lithuania?
I haven't. And I always used to want to go to Russia. I'm not so sure anymore. But maybe someday.
Maybe pause on that for a little while.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a rumor in my family that my dad worked for the CIA, but it's unconfirmed.
Really? Really?
Yeah, because he was, you know, he was a professor of Russian literature, and he made a lot of trips to Russia, and, you know, so he was the perfect sort of cover, you know, for, you know, right. that type of thing.
Right, but no one's going to look, at, no one's gonna look at a professor.
Right.
Wow. So what age was that?
About, you know, like a middle school age, you know, okay. 11 or 12. You know, I started taking lessons when I was in eighth grade. With a real teacher.
Okay. What kind of music were you checking out then?
At that time, I was really into sort of, man, like rock and like goth music and like 80s stuff like Joy Division and Sisters of Mercy and Bauhaus and, you know, more Deftones, like some of the 90s rock. But like, you know, I had very sort of artsy friends, and we used to like go to record stores and like thumb through lots of records. And, you know, I loved that sort of exploring something different and like finding something that was rare that other people didn't know about, or that, you know, my other 13-year-old friends didn't know about. And, you know, so that led me down a lot of interesting sort of paths pretty quickly.
Okay. Okay. Your album is very diverse, I'd say. It's jazz influenced.
Absolutely.
When did you begin studying jazz?
I mean, it was just sort of a little bit the nature of the education system that I had. You know, it's like I'm playing rock and roll with my friends, but I'm trying to get better at the bass and learn as much as I can. And school has a jazz program.
Right.
So I start learning how to play jazz to be in the band. But as I got better at the instrument, jazz really felt like a place that was home for me, just to be able to improvise with other people and sort of express myself in this abstract way where I could release some feelings without necessarily, you know, naming those feelings. Mm-hmm. And people could kind of just share that energy and have this sort of cathartic experience, and also just the joy of studying and challenging myself with other people. You know, that is what I love about jazz.
Yeah. Did you pursue a higher education within jazz or the bass?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I did my undergrad at the New School for Jazz Contemporary Music. Then I got out of school for a while. I tried to make it, didn't work out so well. So I went back to school and I got a master's degree at NYU. And then I was, you know, for about 10 or however many years, I was gigging around town. You know, I'd done Broadway shows and I was up at Radio City Christmas Spectacular and toured and all these things. And then the pandemic hit and it was a little bit of a restart. And so during that time, I decided to go back to school, get one more degree. I'm doing a doctoral studies at Stony Brook University that I'm almost done with.
What is that, in performance?
Knock that off my list. Yeah, it's in jazz performance, yeah.
Okay. What age did you pick up the double bass?
Definitely in high school, probably when I was 14 or 15.
Okay. How'd that transition go? Did you find it pretty natural or yeah, me going from electric to upright was the biggest frustration that is still going on in my life. It's just nonstop. But there's something about it that keeps me coming back.
No, that's definitely the truth. I mean, like, first of all, the instruments you get to play with, you know, we didn't even have like Shen basses or anything. I had this like rock with a string tied to it, with the strings this high off and they're like steel, you know? So yeah. Learning, you know, but I, fortunately at that age, your body can handle it.
Sure. You don't, You kind of don't know that that's not what it should be.
Exactly.
You know, like, you're just like, oh, hard. Yeah, like, wow, but those guys must be really good if they can play like that on bases yeah. like this.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's dig into the record. The record is called The Way okay. I Feel Inside. Talk about the concept for this record. I think it's a really fascinating concept.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, so this album is, it's called The Way I Feel Inside, which is named after the Zombies song, The Way I Feel Inside, which we play on the record. And all the music that's selected for this album come from Wes Anderson films. So the full title of the album is The Way I Feel Inside, inspired by the films of Wes Anderson. And I've been a fan of Wes Anderson's films for a really long time. I sort of came to them during my formative years in high school when I saw The Royal Tenenbaums and The Life Aquatic. And I think that he, as the filmmaker, he has this very sort of unique and specific aesthetic way that he makes his films and tells his stories. And I was particularly fascinated by the music that he uses in his films, like sort of, you know, the Baroque pop of Velvet Underground and the sort of like devastating and poignant, you know, Nick Drake and Elliott Smith. And there's sort of this connect, like the kind of story that Wes Anderson is telling in his films and the stories that are in this, these song choices, there's a connection there. There's a kind of culture that emerges. And I've been reading this book by Mark Spitzer called Twee, The Gentle Revolution. And so Mark Spitzer calls this kind of aesthetic that Wes Anderson has as like twee culture. And it's sort of an aesthetic that's based around a kind of like whimsicalness, a kind of like childlikeness, but always having this sort of close relationship to trauma and sort of adult issues, serious, you know, issue. So it's not escapism in the sense that, you know, we're just doing something whimsical to have a couple hours break from this sort of, you know, human nightmare. Yeah. But there's a relationship between like embracing that whimsicalness to transform that, you know, those issues that people are dealing with. And
I have the book. I pulled up the book right here. So now cool. I was curious about the term twee, which is explained, it's a hybrid generation known as twee, which is the baby boomers and 20 and 30 somethings, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. I'll try to explain it as best I can. I think that a lot of this book is just kind of him like digging on millennials and making fun of us, but okay. There is a sort of, go ahead.
No, that's fine. Like, I'm right at the cusp of millennial. Where do you fall?
Yeah. I'm 37, so, okay. You know, elder millennial, I guess.
Yeah, same.
So, I mean, sort of what, like, he does a history of like, artists he thinks of as twee, and it goes all the way back to sort of, like, Walt Disney, as sort of a proto-twee person who, you know, fought in the war, and you have this whole post-war culture of so much sort of death and horrible things, and he creates this, you know, he creates modern cartoons, sort of, you know, this childlike storytelling that's also for adults as a response to the violence in the world. And you know, as twee sort of finds its sort of mecca in the early 2000s with artists like Wes Anderson, he sort of talks about Zooey Deschanel and like all these sort of like characters who are sort of misfits, but you know, to compare it to something like punk, you know, who are another sort of culture of like misfits, like punk is all about like rebelling and, you know, letting out anger and all these sort of things. But all you sort of need to do to fit into a punk culture, not to, you know, this is Mark Spitzer's words, yeah, is to, you know, get a cool haircut and buy a Sex Pistols record, right?
But sort of, I didn't even know about a record, probably just a shirt. Like, I didn't even know if you need the record.
Right. Yeah. But sort of like the twee character is someone who like knows about literature and collects records and all this stuff, but it's not just because they're smart. It's because it's in a relationship to sort of not feeling included in society, either because of, like, you know, these people are just very shy, or, you know, are dealing with some sort of trauma. It's also usually related to high school type of, you know, youth culture. But sort of the hero of these stories are the interesting kind of gentle nerds who are, you know, trying to figure stuff out. And that's a character I relate to. That's an audience I feel like will hopefully relate to my story, which I've tried to sort of, you know, I've taken this concept of Wes Anderson's aesthetic and I've used these songs, but I don't really see them so much as cover songs. It's sort of like reinterpretations of this aesthetic, trying to tell my story. And some of the songs I've selected are intended to do that. I can go into that in a little bit more detail later.
Man, I looked up Mark Spitz too. He passed away.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He passed away in 2017.
Damn.
So
I'll never hear my album.
He was only 47. It's like, dude, you weren't even really old enough to be ranting about another generation yet.
I know. Yeah. Huh.
Yeah, he's got a couple books out.
Yeah, I mean, he's a good writer. I definitely enjoyed it.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So you're coming at it from that approach.
Yeah.
Now, when I checked it out, it's obviously jazz influenced. It's kind of also, how do I want to put this to make sure I'm communicating it like I heard it? Theatrically charged.
Yes. Okay. That is accurate.
Great.
Yeah.
Anytime you talk about someone else's music, it's it's walking on a frozen lake.
I get it. It's been really fun, you know, especially to see some of the first couple of reviews come in. And it's like, wow, you know, this writer, like, who knows nothing about me, kind of gets it. Like, that's awesome. That means, you know, I've communicated it well enough, I guess.
How did you now, conceptually, you just spoke of kind of like the artistic motivation that led you down some of those paths. Compositionally, how did you approach this? Because there's, on first listen, you know, when your PR people gave me a copy of the record, I'm thinking like, okay, this sounds like an interesting jazz record. Track one happens, I'm like, all right. Is that harpsichord right out of the gate? Like, what am I hearing? I didn't expect that. I'm interested. I'm definitely interested. Track two comes around. That took another turn. So how did you approach this as a composer or a producer of the record?
Yeah. well, I've been working in the music industry for about 17 years, give or take, you know, and this is the first record that I've put out. So even before I had the concept of making this sort of Wes Anderson album, I wanted my first album to reflect my experiences in the industry, to sort of, you know, these are all the kind of gigs I've had and these are all the things I've learned and this is all that I bring to the table. This is my experience. This is what I find interesting. And there's, you know, I never thought when I got out of college that I would end up be working in musical theater. Or, you know, I spent about 5 years playing like traditional jazz, you know, the kind of like old school, you know, slap of the bass, spang-a-lang. Yeah. But I learned something from all those experiences and I found things that, you know, from the indie kid who was originally into like the most gothic shit to be doing musical theater, you know, it's a hard turn, but,
it seems like they would be closely.
Yeah, they
have more similarities than differences.
Honestly, that's the truth. It's just sort of bias.
Like if you take away all the black nail polish, you're left with thespians. That's what I think.
Yeah. that's super accurate. Yeah.
All right.
So I wanted it to have all these different aspects of my life and my personality, which is why it sort of it moves around a lot. One of my favorite composers is this guy named Gary McFarland, who was a composer in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And he is such an interesting composer because his music is just so full of these unexpected turns. And his first record was, which is not even my favorite record. I love his original music much better. But his first record was all music from, it was sort of his version of the Frank Lesser musical, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying.
Okay.
And, you know, this record is just so Gary McFarland. Like, it's, he just makes these like fascinating like jazz charts out of all these tunes. And that was another part of the concept of what I wanted to do, you know, is to really put my spin on this music and make lots of unexpected things happen. And my arrangement of Rebel Rebel on the record is directly influenced by Gary McFarland, who did these 60s records when Bossa Nova was just starting, called, the first one was called Soft Samba Strings.
Yeah.
And he, you know, buries the melody. He does like Beatles tunes in a bossa nova style, but he like buries the melody and writes these new melodies on top of it. And then like, instead of singing the lyrics, he'll just go, type of thing. It's so 60s. It's so fun.
Yeah.
And
that's definitely the vibe of Rebel Rebel. Like, it just like, I didn't know the tune, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm like, Rebel Rebel. Okay. Something with some angst, maybe. And then, no, it's just like this Nancy Sinatra vibe with vibraphones happening. That was cool. It was cool.
Thank you.
There's not one set of instrumentation throughout the record. Like, each tune has its different, is kind of instrumentated or orchestrated for the tune, which is cool. Were these all recorded at the same session? Or were they kind of pieced together over a couple years or something?
We did two dates at Bunker Studios.
Okay.
Where we recorded all eight songs. I had kind of core band is like a 7-piece band with a saxophone doubler, trombone, our vocalist Sammy Stevens, and then the rhythm section, drums, bass, guitar, and piano. Mm-hmm. There's a couple songs where we don't have the horns on it, like Needle in the Hay and Cello Song. And there are a couple songs where we add instruments to that. We did it all live in the studio, except for I overdubbed a few things, such as the harpsichord, some of the other instruments in The Way I Feel Inside. The introduction has like a French horn choir, and I just had one person overdub the French horn, some other stuff like that.
Did the studio have a harpsichord?
They didn't. I've done a gig for a few summers at the Utah Opera and Musical Theater Festival, where I fly out there for the summer and play like a rotation of musicals and operas. And there was a really good harpsichord player there, and the festival had their own recording people. So I was like, I could get this done right now. Like, let's get in the room and record this harpsichord. So that's what we did.
Let's kill it.
And that's Dallas Heaton, who's a fantastic harpsichordist.
Oh, and Dallas lives in Utah, or Dallas is
yes.
Because you're in New York, correct?
Yes, I'm in Brooklyn.
Yeah. Okay. A quick tangent. You play on Broadway. I've been hearing over here just a bunch of people spouting off about the scene on Broadway right now.
Yeah.
I haven't really checked in with my Broadway friends too much about it. Some of them are just eternally dark on the whole thing. So I can't get a fair gauge on it all. What's the scene like over there in New York about the Broadway?
Are you talking specifically about Here Lies Love?
Is that the thing I'm thinking of?
Let me give you a tea.
What's his name? Bird basically sidestepping to use pre-recorded music. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. Here's the thing. There's been a trend in Broadway for smaller and smaller orchestras over the past years. Producers are trying to save some money.
Sure.
The union is trying to fight to keep those jobs there. And David Byrne has this new musical coming out called Here's Lies Love, which I believe is open now. I don't know the whole story, but it's something about a dictator in the Philippines, and the Philippines have this culture of karaoke that's really big over there. And so David Byrne you know, conceptually wanted this the music to feel like a karaoke show. And that's kind of how he pitched it. Now, to record the music for this show, he hired 40 musicians to like make the record for the show. Okay. But the concept to do it live was with zero musicians.
Right.
Or maybe one musician who's like, you know, programming everything. And the theater that he's doing the show at has a contract with the union that the shows are required to have 19 musicians, which is a pretty large orchestra. There's this thing called, I'm getting very technical here, this thing called the special circumstances rule or whatever. And that's where producers can say, listen, our show just does not call for that many musicians. We want to make some sort of deal with the union. We'll contribute to your pension fund or something like that and use a smaller orchestra. That's happened on a couple occasions. Mamma Mia was one of those shows. But basically David Byrne and his team were like, no, we want it. This is my concept. I want to do it with, you know, tracks. And then the musicians union, you know, really fought hard and they got stories into the New York Times, into these big newspapers that started to actually drum up some resistance to this thing in the public and a backlash. And what ended up happening after some negotiations is that David Byrne and his team caved and there are going to be 12 musicians on the show when it opens. It's a big victory. It's a little bit of a loss too, because we've cut from 19 to 12, but you know, it's better than zero. So yeah, I mean, it's a tough environment for sure. It's a beautiful community. It's a fun job and you know, fighting the good fight, I guess.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that it had been flipped. This is probably around like maybe 2 weeks ago was when I heard about all the other stuff, and then like they weren't going to use anybody, and you know, I think we all kind of feel that a little bit anytime the occupation gets even more threatened by anything. And it was just like, so then even people over here that are don't even do musicals, you know, there's really one. There's Pantages out here. That's the only real theater gig that's of note. Yeah, but even people that aren't doing Pantages out here, like everybody's up in arms and posting and
creating. Yeah, they should be.
Yeah, and I think so, but it's funny. It's just funny what everybody's take on things is. And I'm glad that they opened it up to at least have some people in it.
Yeah.
I mean, part of me, artistically, feels like that's a bummer that his vision didn't get realized for his piece of work. I do think that sucks.
I think that there is, I've heard some people with that take. I think that there, you know, a lot of people hear him say that and they're just like, you know, F this guy. Like, no, that's just a bullshit excuse.
Yeah, but I mean, ultimately, I'd rather have musician work.
I take him at face value that this is what he believes is what's best for the show. The thing is, I think what's happening is bigger than that. And it's more important that, like, if this were to happen, if he were able to create a Broadway show that has zero musicians, it's like, boom, the door's open for that. And that's what it's going to be.
Right.
And that's a nightmare, you know?
Yeah. Ain't a runaway train. Everybody's just going to see, like, what? What are we paying? How much can we save?
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
Yeah, that's going to snowball quickly. So, although artistically, I think that about what he was intending to do, it's more important to me that musicians stay in the scene.
We'll be back right after this.
All right, folks. All right. I'm doing a new thing. I'm offering up the middle of the show, right? The middle of the episode. I'm offering it up to you. That's right. If you have a new single out, you have a new album out, if you would simply like to get heard by the bass community, you give a shout out to your social media handles, you know, your Spotify page, whatever it may be, hit me up. Stop by thebassshed.com and get featured on the Bass Shed podcast.
Excellent, sir.
The record in total is 7 tracks.
8 tracks.
8 tracks, really? Did I only get 7? What happened here? Huh. All right. Well, I mean, you would know better than me. I thought it was. What happened to the tab? I forgot what happened to the tab here with your. I had your stuff open. Anyways, all right. It's 8 tracks. The last track I have is Cello Song. What's the song after Cello Song?
Yeah, you didn't get These Days.
No.
Oops.
Okay.
Yeah, let me send it to you. I'll drop it in the chat.
Okay, cool.
I'll send you the music video.
Oh, there's a music video.
Yeah, that's the one we have a music video for.
That was sweet. What point did you know you wanted to write at a record or at least a collection of material based on Wes Anderson films? Or some of these,
Yeah.
Ideas.
I mean, it started off a little bit of a, you know, like I've been writing music off and on all this time, and every once in a while I'll come back to, you know, doing a cover of a song that I love. And I certainly love, like, you know, the stuff that Brad Mehldau and the Bad Plus were doing in like the late 90s, 2000s, sure, where they're covering more indie artists. You know, I thought that was, you know, a very cool thing. And you know, so I wanted to do something like that as well. And the first arrangement I did was this Stephanie Says arrangement by the Velvet Underground, minus the harpsichord and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I had put it up on the internet as a little video, and I, you know, kind of put in the chat, at, you know, like, wouldn't it be kind of cool if I did something that was kind of like a Wes Anderson concept, like all music from Wes Anderson movies? And people were like, yeah, that's a great idea. And I was like, okay, this could be cool. And then I didn't really do anything with it for a while. But once the pandemic hit and I suddenly had all this time, I started to really dig into, exploring this music and really, you know, this could work, you know, this could be an album. And that's sort of how it started.
Okay. Are you kind of like a movie buff? Are you really into cinema?
I like movies. I've seen a lot of movies. I have a lot of opinions about movies. I can't really call myself a movie buff, you know, but not in the same way that I'm a music buff.
Sure. But, sure.
Yeah. I have seen every Wes Anderson movie, though. I will say that.
You know, I don't know. When I got the info about this record, and apparently not all 8 tracks.
I have to talk to Chris about that.
Yeah, yeah. I had to look them up. I'm like, because obviously I know of Wes Anderson by name, and everybody just talks about Wes Anderson films as Wes Anderson films. You know, like the whole collection all the time, similar to like the Coen brothers. But I'm like, what are they? So I had to like Google, what are Wes Anderson films? I've seen, I think, maybe one or two.
Yeah.
But not a lot. And that being said, I'm not like a big movie guy at all. I watch a ton of true crime documentaries. That's all I that's just kind of my thing. But I've seen Rushmore and I saw Life Aquatic.
Yeah.
Those were hilarious.
Yeah.
So after I saw those, I'm like, okay, that's kind of the feel of the thing. Now I get it. The tune, The Way I Feel Inside. I when I was listening to the record, this is the first track two on the album, but the first one in playlist order that has vocals on it.
Yes.
After the vocals, really long bass solo. Is the bass solo meant to make the narrative personal?
That's a good question. It wasn't in my conception to do that necessarily, but the song is a little bit of a long form.
Yeah.
So when you play over it, it's a long solo. But I mean, honestly, the answer is yes. Because I mean that song is kind of the whole concept of the record.
Sure.
In a few ways, I feel like, one of the things I've talked about is this concept of a mixtape, as something personal that you like back in the day, you'd give a mixtape to someone.
Sure.
And that mixtape could be kind of a placeholder for how it feels to be you. I mean, in a way, it's like these songs that I've chosen are me, and I want you to understand what it feels like to be me, or I want you to understand how I feel about you. And that's sort of the concept of naming the album The Way I Feel Inside. But on a more personal level, like this song, when the Zombies performed it, it's just like an unaccompanied vocal of the melody. It's very intimate and personal. And the lyrics are, you know, about this sort of unrequited love, like trying to hold in, you know, feelings and conceal the way you feel. Should I try to hide the way I feel inside? And I've always felt like it's a great metaphor for the queer experience, because, mm-hmm. you know, I came out a little bit later in life, so I certainly have concealed a lot of feelings over time. And that's why this track is also very personal to me, because it's something that I relate to.
Is it, in a sense, a little bit of, how do I say it, the musical story of that process for you? Of maybe the absolutely. Struggle and then the freedom of it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole record is sort of, you know, like a Wes Anderson story. It's whimsical, but sort of processing my own traumas. You know, the birth of my love of music was from my father, and then, you know, dealing with this unresolved issues of identity. So, you know, you have songs like The Way I Feel Inside. You have These Days, which is sort of this reflection on regret, and sort of my arrangement takes it to a little bit more of a major place, a little bit more of a sense of acceptance. The song So Long I included for my ex-wife a little bit, sort of my feelings about that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's my story.
Did doing this album and kind of doing a deep dive emotionally on these, you know, on your story and really getting in touch with different parts of your past and your present, all that stuff, was it cathartic? Did it help you process or heal or empower? Or what's been the takeaways since doing this process for you on an emotional level?
Man, that's a tough question, because right now I'm still so in it, you know, with sort of the trying to get the story out and, you know, get the CD release party and book the gigs. And like, there's just so much anxiety. I don't feel like I'm able to process, you know, how I feel just yet. But, mm-hmm. And part of that will come a little bit from the response of audiences and critics and such. But that is certainly the goal. And that is, you know, what I hope, audiences will, you know, get to process how they feel about things as well. And, you know, there definitely is a sense of growth, you know, from this album. I will say that. Yeah.
It's a big thing to do, you know, like I remember when I got done recording mine, it was like after the session, I was done with it. Cause like it was done, you know, like
it's so hard to listen to.
Oh my gosh. I can't stand listening to it. meanwhile, I'm going to run ads for it on this episode. But after I tracked it, it was just like, okay, I'm done, because now it's out of me. Like the music is out of me now. It got realized, it got played, it was recorded. No one had heard it, but I was done with it.
Yeah.
And so it just sat on a hard drive for like 9 months before I did anything to it. To like, it felt like a time warp to go back and revisit this, even though I had already, I'm on to the next one, you know?
And
I'm
like, and then to be talking about it for 6 to 9 months,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, right.
It's kind of crazy. And for me, it's like, I mean, art is never sort of finished, right? Like, I hear it now and I'm like, oh, I could have changed this and that. And also like, you know, when I started this project, you know, Wes Anderson was this thing from like my past who hadn't really emerged in the public's culture all that much. And like recently, I don't know if you've seen all these like TikTok videos of people like doing the Wes Anderson trend, and then there's these AI videos of like, what if Wes Anderson directed Star Wars? So he's so like in the cultural zeitgeist right now, and it's giving me all these ideas. Like if I made the album today, it would already be different than the one I made in September of 2022.
Sure.
But you gotta live with that too, you know? That's what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're all just Polaroid pictures. You know, like that's what happened that day, you know, and everything that was influencing you that day was a part of that. And for better or worse, you're stuck with it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Would you ever give him a copy? Would you ever?
We're trying to figure out how to do that. Yeah.
Where's he at? Yeah. Is he in New York?
I honestly don't know. I don't think so. I imagine he's on some sort of whimsical private island.
Do you enjoy writing for larger groups?
I do. You know, one thing as a bass player that I've found kind of challenging is that, you know, when I play in kind of pickup jazz groups where we have like one rehearsal before a gig, you know, if you're the piano player, you know, you put a chart in front of the rhythm section with some, you know, some bass lines, some hits or whatever. We're good readers. We can like, you know, all the hard stuff's in the piano, you know?
Right.
So we can just nail this on one rehearsal. As a bass player, to do a trio, you know, and I put something difficult in front of a guitar player or a piano player, it's like, we're either going to need a lot of rehearsals, which can be difficult, or it's going to be it might be a little sloppy on the gig, you know? So like being able to expand the ensemble, one is fun for me as a writer because I get to work with a lot of like counterpoint and stuff like that, but it also sort of spreads the responsibility around a little bit where I'm not just counting on one musician to handle all the melodies and carry the band. I mean, if I were a better bass player, I would be maybe doing all the melodies on the bass, but that's just not the way I write.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, you can run that into the ground pretty quick.
Yeah.
You know,
for sure. Yeah.
When writing for instruments like French horn and stuff, did you have to learn a little bit about the instrument?
Well, my degree from the New School was composition. Like, okay. I was a composition major. And when I was in college, so this was I was one of five composition majors in the New School, and it was the last year that they had that program. Okay. So it was like all these like killing performers. Like, there are some very famous people from my grade, like Galat Hexelman, Jamar Williams, like tons of other people. And
what year were you there?
2004 2008.
Okay. I think I know some people that might have been there around that time.
I'm sure you do. Yeah. So anyway, like, I've felt a little bit like, you know, a little bit like an outsider, because everyone were these like, I mean, a lot of people feel that way in college when you get into a good conservatory where suddenly you were the best bass player in your little hometown, and now you're in New York City, and there's right, all these right. people that are. But the thing I did to kind of like find my own thing is I put together this really big band. I had a 13-piece band.
Wow.
And I got these musicians to like show up every Sunday to the New School to rehearse my music. Even when I didn't have new music to rehearse, like, we just rehearsed every week. We had a set time.
Okay.
And it was like the most creative period of my life. I was like so happy. I was writing a lot. I was really sort of couldn't really play, you know, as well as I can now, but I felt like as my voice, you know, if you heard some of that music that I was writing then, you could really hear the connection to this album. But what ended up happening, you know, I got out of college and I thought I'm going to bring this band to the world. Paying 13 musicians to play New York City venues is like, I'm losing $1,000 a show, you know, yeah. And I'm working at Lowe's.
Sure.
So, you know, so that was a very devastating moment for me. That was a moment when I sort of decided, okay, I need to figure out how to have a career in music. Mm-hmm. And so for the past 15, 17 years, you know, that's what I've done. I've gotten gigs, I've gotten onto the scene, I've honed my chops as a sideman, I've done theater and, you know, got my bow chops together and all this different stuff. But it you know, in the pandemic, it's like when all that sort of ended, like, it made me realize like this thing that I'm missing, that's really what made me the most happy about making music is making my own music, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's the hardest thing to do in the music business, because, you know, it really is. I mean, it's also can be the most lucrative and successful if you hit it big. You know, obviously all the big stars play their own music. They don't play, you know, top 40 or jazz standards sure. necessarily. I mean, sometimes they do. Jazz is a little different.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, so this was kind of my, you know, this was my shot, and, you know, I put everything I could into it, and, you know.
And so was it a full reinventing of the career during the pandemic to really kind of put all your eggs in this basket and not necessarily give up on the working sideman stuff, but back burner that and go artist forward?
I mean, Kind of. I mean, it was certainly a break from doing the other things. Now I'm doing them again. You know, yeah. I'm playing around town with everybody that I can, and I hope to continue that. But there are some gigs I would, you know, turn down now to make more space to do the, you know, creative stuff. And you know, there is a whole process. You know, booking gigs takes a lot of energy, and then, you know, promoting them and organizing music and rehearsal. Like there is a huge chunk of energy and effort you have to put into that, and that is difficult on top of everything else, but you do have to carve out time for it.
Yeah, just the administrative stuff. There's a lot of rejection, yeah. A lot of no answers. Ooh, to emails. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's awful. It's awful.
Yeah.
But you got a PR guy. How's that work?
I do. Ugh, Chris is the best. Honestly, okay. Chris DiGiorolamo, if anyone ever needs a PR guy, you got to get this guy. He's like, as always, made me feel like he's very invested in my project. And, cool. You know, we're in constant contact. Like, he'll just send me like texts and messages to let me know what he's up to, what he did recently, what he's trying to pull for. And, you know, I just feel like I trust him and he's doing a great job. So
sweet.
For a new artist, I feel very grateful.
That's great. Have you seen some traction? Have you do you pay attention to the numbers on that? I kind of geek out on analytic numbers.
Yeah, well the album's not out yet. The album comes out July 7th.
Okay, so this is all
I haven't been able to see. We're all in the pre-release phase. I know that, you know, our music video has about 3,000 views on YouTube right now, which is a lot for me. That seems like, you know, making progress there. I have a little Kickstarter to sort of help, you know, we're selling some pre-order CDs and some t-shirts and stuff like that.
Cool.
And that's about 75% funded. So, you know, it seems like everything's going on track, you know, fingers crossed.
Okay. Yeah. What's kind of the hope with this record? You want to take this band on the road? You want to kind of just make a name for yourself as a solo artist and then just follow it up with another record?
I mean, I definitely, my next record, whenever I make it, will be all original music. So that will be, you know, the next step in sort of my recording career. I definitely want to perform with this band. I think that we have, you know, like a certain kind of niche where we can, you know, like we're doing a concert at Birdland later this year. And, you know, we've advertised it as Marty Eisenberg's Wes Anderson playlist. So there's a very, I want to keep doing this project, but I also want it to sort of morph into like a little bit more of an original music project with some of these arrangements in the repertoire. But yeah, you know, the goal is to create space in my life to be able to like play at some venues that I don't have to ask all my friends and family to show up for, some of the, like, you know, more well-known jazz establishments where we can, you know, promote, but show up and play and have some consistent growth with a band.
Right. Our venues over there is fussy as
they're fussy.
I imagine them to be. Like, I know they're fussy out here, and I can only imagine with even more of a jazz scene over there that it's going to be.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there are the venues that have built-in audiences that you don't have to worry about, and that's where everybody wants to play. And then there are the sort of next tier venues where they are jazz centric, you know, like people know that that jazz happens there, but you still have to kind of bring your own audience. And then I guess there's, you know, everything else, but those are the places you need to navigate.
Cool. Do you got some ideas rattling around for the next?
Honestly, no, not yet.
Okay.
I'm writing songs, I'm writing some tunes and stuff, but I don't know if it will be a fully conceptual album again, or I know that, you know, when I love albums and I want every album I make to tell a story. I feel like if my album is just sort of like a grouping of tunes, it's not going to have the same, it's not going to be gripping to an audience in the same way as if I'm able to tell some sort of story through the music.
Sure.
So I don't have an overarching concept yet, but, you know, I'm working on it.
Yeah, I mean, you're still really spending a lot of emotional time and energy.
Yes, yeah, I'm definitely
doing this phase
fully
of this one.
In this album. Yeah. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
I mean, that's probably a good thing, you know, instead of just like, all right, on to the next one, and then no one, you know, hears this or knows about this one, or
right, yeah. And honestly, that's what a lot of musicians do, and it's yeah. sort of I want to tell them like, get your album out. It's so good, you know, like, but it's tough.
Yeah, it is tough. It is tough. And I mean, I think, like, I kind of get it from both sides because I just enjoy the creative process. I think seeing it finally get across the finish line was enough for me.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, it's like, in the back of my mind, I'm like, no one's gonna, it's fine. Like, who cares? Maybe they'll listen to it. Maybe they'll like it. I don't give a shit. It's not like I'm gonna retire off that record. So, like, whatever. You know, just on to, I'd rather just be a part of the creative process and then instead of trying to squeeze pennies out of this thing and probably investing more money than I'll make back on it.
Yeah. No, I think that's a totally, like, healthy and like, you know.
I don't know if it's healthy or self-sabotage.
I don't know, man. I mean, it seems like, you know, to have that much love for the creative process that you are not, you know, it's not the end goal that people love you is kind of, you know, a healthy, or at least a cool way to approach it.
Yeah, I don't need, it's not necessarily about the attention, it's just about the creative.
That was
How are you on stage then? Are you really good at like when you're leading a band?
I am, yeah.
Are you really comfortable there? I'm not comfortable. I'm comfortable on stage. But as soon as I have to like engage a crowd, for some reason I act like I don't know how to talk or anything. Which is hilarious because doing this, I'm talking
to
people.
Right, you're a professional talker.
Yeah, and I'm talking to people I've never met before. But if I'm on a stage, I can't. I have to think about it. Like, dude, just think about it like you're doing a podcast. Just think about it like you're doing a podcast, and like kind of psych myself out.
Yeah,
but you're good.
No,
you're good.
I love it. I don't know if I'm how good I am at it, but I love it.
As long as you love it, cool.
Talking to the audience and trying to tell jokes. I think, you know. If I were even crazier than I am, I would have wanted to be a comedian, you know.
Me too, actually. Yeah. I think ultimately that is my dream job, and somehow I just ended up as a bass player.
Exactly,
But like the more I get into comedy, the more I'm just like, man, that's insane.
Oh, it's brutal. It's so brutal.
One person, like one person. I know, controlling a whole room, a whole theater, and like there's no bullshit. They're not fake laughing at you. They just don't laugh.
Yeah.
You know, like people can fake applaud after a tune's
over.
Yes,
that's true. That's
but
true.
They cannot fake
point.
Laugh as a group like that. It's so, I'm assuming, very unforgiving.
Yeah.
Yeah, but me too. I always think that'd be cool. And I've gotten really more into comedy. Not personally, but just within the art of it.
Yeah.
I do think there's fascinating that we're talking about this. I think that there's a relationship between comedians and musicians somewhere in there. Dave Chappelle made some quote where like, what is it? Comedians can play an instrument and all musicians think they're funny. Like there was a kind of an angle where it was a dig on musicians and I got pissed.
Yeah.
I'm like, shut up, Chappelle, shut up. We're funnier because we don't write our jokes. All right.
Yeah.
You guys work this shit out. We're just crushing this right off the top of our heads.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, like the life of a musician, you know, you're hanging out in a van with four other people and like all day long, you're just trying to make each other laugh, you know, like that's kind of the thing.
But I mean, even like the lifestyle and the occupation, there's something very, there's a lot of parallels to it.
I think I can tell you what it is. We want attention, you know?
I mean, everybody does though. Do you think that's unique to the artist? I don't think it's unique to the artist.
I think, well, I mean, so that's sort of the interesting thing with the social media revolution is that it gives everyone sort of that access to attention that used to be only for people in the performing arts. I think that everybody wants attention. We're all born as babies and receive the love of our parents and, you know, or some of us don't, which makes you want attention even more. I understand, you know. So there is something about, I think there is something about people that go into the performing arts that is craving attention, you know? I think so. Everybody does, but I think it's especially us.
I do think that people that go into performing arts are trying to reconcile something.
That too. Yeah.
Whether it's like specifically attention, or maybe it was trying to reconcile the lack of attention they got and they're trying to find their place in the world. I do think that pretty much we're all trying to reconcile something.
Yeah.
And we get into this thing before we even know what we're trying to reconcile or how to talk about it.
Yep. Yeah.
It's a fascinating sociological thing to be a part of, because I know I just go down these rabbit holes where I'm constantly investigating my own brain and why the hell I'm doing any of this.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I love being creative and, like I mentioned, the creative process, but more often than not, I hate the occupation of being a musician. You know what I mean? Yes. Like,
sometimes, yeah.
I love playing music. I love playing the bass. I love all that. But the nature of like what gigs pay, and you get to do your own taxes, and the occupation of it sucks.
And just the constant energy level of it, you know, it can be exhausting. You know,
oh my
it's
like gosh,
constantly moving around, like trying to keep up. You know, like even when you're inspired by other people, you're sort of like, oh shit, I gotta practice more so I can be more like them. You know, and then it's like, when the hell am I gonna do that? You know?
Yeah, no. I know. In addition to being around and working with people that are all sorting out their own head too, you know, and you're like, you're around all these super interesting personality types. They can be draining. It's a lot. It's funny. Like, I wonder why I do this, but then at the same time, this is still the only thing I want to be doing.
Yeah.
You know, it's fascinating. The whole nature of people that get into this. It's fascinating.
Yeah. It is.
Who are some of those people that inspire you? Besides Wes Anderson, obviously.
Like musicians?
Musicians, maybe specifically bass players or other composers. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
You mentioned Gary McFarlane, but who are some others?
Some of my favorite bass players are Larry Grenadier, Charlie Hayden. I mean, I like a bass player who is virtuosic, but kind of, it's not about that. Their playing isn't about how much they can do on the instrument. It's a little bit more what they can do with the instrument and finding their individuality through being really precise with what they're trying to say. And I feel like Larry Grenadier is the best at that. You know, he's so
that is
fascinating.
A bass player's bass player. He's like the double bass equivalent of like Pino Palladino. Like, he's just a bass player's bass player.
Yes. Yeah. Also, I love Pino Palladino.
Yeah, Pino's
the shit. I like some of the big large ensemble composers like Bob Brookmeyer, Marie Schneider, Darcy James Arquet. I love Charles Mingus. I mean, his music, it's just so, like, you can't write down his music. That's what's so amazing about it. It's just like somehow it's all created in a way that it's dependent on these musicians that are in his orbit, and it's just like so deep. Sun Ra, you know, anything that sort of is weird and interesting to me. I have other influences too, like Radiohead is a band that I love. I love what Wolfpack is doing. I think it's a super cool vibe. Yeah, those are a few of my cats.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple, like, some common denominators are these groups and musicians that are kind of left of center. Did you get into a lot of, like, singer-songwriters, like Elliott Smith, Damien Rice?
Yes.
People like that are kind of like, you know, the old 97s. Like, they're there, but they're always off to the side. Kind of.
Yeah.
And I think they choose to stay there.
Yeah.
Like, so many of those, I mean, Elliot has passed, but so many of them have successful careers and never really, you know, Dr. John was one of those artists. Like, he just always purposely stayed on the side.
Yeah.
Is that something you are kind of can identify with or are attracted to?
Absolutely.
In a sense, because it Absolutely. Maybe gives it makes it more unique if it's not part of the machine.
Yeah, and it's personal, and it's uncompromising in its vision, and it's not for the sort of normal consumer. It's not made for everyone, and mm-hmm. I think that, you know, there is something fascinating about like artists who are able to sort of capture that sort of zeitgeist and create something that everyone is into. But like, those artists are never really the people that speak as much to me, because I want something a little bit more unique and a little mm-hmm. bit more unexplored. You know, I want to be surprised when I'm listening to music.
Sure.
I want to be taken on a journey.
Sure. The problem with that, after you've listened to so much music and performed so much music, is
it's hard to feel that.
Yeah, and you've and I think most performers already have, let's say, at least 95% more. You've experienced more with irregular concepts or music, whatever. You've taken more turns than the average person. So what you're looking for, how do I say it? Having the listener take the turn that still inspires you without losing them is a challenge.
Mm. Yeah, that's a great point. I hadn't really thought about that.
Because, you know, they can easily be lost, and meanwhile you're over here like, I've already been down that road, I know where it leads, you know, like whatever.
Yeah
But creating this brand new territory over here that's still inspiring to, you know, someone who's well traveled, to keep the analogy going, that's not necessarily the terrain for the novice hiker.
Yeah,
and now I'm done with the outdoors analogies. I ran that shit into the ground.
I think that there's something, and this is something I've talked about a lot with Ray Anderson, who's a trombone player, who's my advisor at Stony Brook, and he has had the most like weird career. Like he's been like an avant-garde trombonist over, you know, his entire career, doing really weird stuff, and he's a total free spirit, amazing guy. But something we've talked about a lot is sort of, no matter what you're doing, no matter how far out it is, or how complicated it is, because a lot of modern jazz is like super complicated, you know, there needs to be this aspect to the music that you're making that connects to a universal human experience, you know, something that you can relate to, even if you don't know what the hell is going on, you know, because if your music loses that, then it becomes a little, you know, academic or like not as meaningful. So even when you're making these turns that are surprising, there needs to be this sense of telling a human story, you know, and that's, you know, something that I try to keep in my concept.
That I agree. On topic of telling a human experience in this culture that is so driven by the rise of AI, social media, which is just everybody's highlight reel, that's not a human connection at all. That's who they want, who they wish they were every day, basically.
Mm-hmm. Or their brand.
Yeah, exactly, whatever it is. So that's, in normal society, we're dealing with daily the decline of a human experience.
Mm-hmm.
So combating that with music, or through music, like really touching the human experience. What are some other ways you're, like, within the longevity of your career, that you're, you know, things to continue to pursue that? Because mm-hmm. next year at this time, who knows where we'll be? You know, Sarah Connor's carving No Fate into a picnic table. And they're coming.
They're coming for us.
I'm glad you got that reference.
Yeah. I mean, that's a very good question. And I think it's something that, you know, all musicians have to think about in their career. You know, you have to have this sort of multi-pronged, especially as acoustic instrumentalists or jazz musicians, whatever it is, this multi-pronged approach to what you're bringing to the world. It's not just about the music that you're making. There's a level of sort of creating audience awareness about the importance of music, and that's I consider sort of advocacy in some ways. Mm-hmm. And then there's, you know, education. We you know, there's training the next generation of musicians, and you know, you do that by just sharing what you love, you know?
Yeah. All right, curious. Cool, man. Yeah, thanks again for being on. And
yeah, man.
Anything new comes up, let me know.
I appreciate that, man. I'm gonna follow your stuff. I this was really fun.
All right. That was my talk with Marty Eisenberg. Again, his album is titled The Way I Feel Inside. Highly recommend checking it out. It's on all the things. It's on all the platforms. You can stop by his website, MartyEisenberg.com. I have links up to all of that at thebayshed.com/podcast/Marty Eisenberg. That's about all I got for this one, folks. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, please hit subscribe wherever you are listening to it. Please give it a rating, give it a thumbs up, give it whatever engagement thing there is, you know, if it's a heart, if is it a thumbs up, is it a whatever. I'm not even, you know, I don't even know, whatever. Okay, so I gotta talk about this, right? So Meta has this new one out. It has this new one called Threads. I don't even know, I saw this thing on Instagram and I clicked on it, just a series of numbers, and then all of a sudden I'm signed up for it, and it's like the new Twitter, or they're trying to compete with Twitter or something. I don't know. Just why can't the two billionaires just like stay in your own lane, huh? Just Elon can keep Twitter and Tesla, and then Zuckerberg, you have Instagram and Facebook and whatever else you're doing. Just stay in your own lane, huh? Stay in your own lane, everybody. Whatever. I don't even know what I'm ranting about there. I don't even know what I'm ranting about. That's all I got for this one. I will catch you on the next one in a minute.